Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Mind Shifters Radio with the Forgiveness Doctor, Dr. Michael Rice. I'm Jeannie Rice, your co-host. We also have co-hosts Dr. Tim Hayes and Michelle Bichette. We will share with you the wisdom of the first century Aramaic internal process of forgiveness. We offer tools and support 5 days a week. We will support you in building a solid foundation within yourself to live in pure love, in Aramaic, Brachma. Michael is the author of the book, Why Is This Happening to Me Again? For more information about the forgiveness process, please visit www.whyagain.org. And now, welcome to the show, Mind Shifters Radio.
Hello and welcome to Mind Shifters Radio. I'm Tim Hayes. I'm your host for the first hour. And today is Thursday, March 10th, 2022. As always, we're grateful to everyone who's joining us here today, whether you're listening live or through the archives, as we spend another couple of hours teaching and supporting people in using some of the most powerful, effective, efficient, and accessible tools I've ever encountered. These tools are available absolutely free through the tireless efforts of Dr. Michael and Jeannie Rice. To get access to them, simply go to the website at whyagain.org, whyagain.org. Once you're there, go to the upper left-hand corner, and there will be a Start Here link. On that link, it'll take you to a page where you can download and read Chapter 24 of Dr. Michael Rice's book, Why Is This Happening to Me Again? That chapter of that book contains a narrative description of the primary tool in this work. That tool is called the Reality Management Worksheet, sometimes called the Reality Management Wake-Up Sheet. And it's a tool I've been using to great effect for over 17 years, almost 18 years now, to improve the quality of my life and most of my relationships, and to turn any negative emotional experience I have into part of the infallible guidance system that each and every one of us has been given. You can also download the actual worksheet process itself. It's a simple PDF file. Click on the link, download it, print it out, copy it, and use it as often as you'd like, absolutely free. You can also go to your app store and type in the three words, Heartland Aramaic Forgiveness. And before you're done typing the word forgiveness, you'll see the glowing heart icon. If you tap on that, that will let you download a completely free and private app that contains the Reality Management Worksheet. It contains an abbreviated version of that worksheet process. And it contains a copy of the Dragon Klingon game, which is a wonderful way to introduce these tools to even younger audiences. We hope you do that soon and often, because as you download that tool and start to use it in your life, you're likely to have comments or questions or testimonials or even answers for us. And if you have any of those and you'd like to share them with us, give us a call at 563-999-3581. While you're on that page, you can also download a whole host of audio files of shows just like this one, where people have called in and either been stepped through the worksheet process or asked clarifying questions about how it works or how to use it, or they've given powerful testimonials about how the actual application of that tool in their lives has been a great benefit. Today's a Thursday, which means at 6:30 p.m. Central Time, we'll have another support group offering, and it's absolutely free. If you're interested, you can donate if you choose, but it's not required, and the information about how to join us there is available at mindshiftersacademy.org. And please remember, there's a separate sign-in information packet page for each day. It doesn't work to try and log in on a Thursday night using the Tuesday night login. I think that's all the housekeeping. There will be another recorded show for the second hour today. Michael and Jeannie have other pressing family business. And we have plenty of time for conversation. We have over 50 minutes if we choose to use it all. Our call-in number is 563-999-3581. If you call that number and press 1, it'll put the little icon of a hand by your phone number, and I'll turn on your microphone and announce you by your area code. So before we start to dig into the last few pages of Lesson 5 in the Way of Mastery, I will ask if we have any comments or questions, answers, clarifications, requests for help with a worksheet, testimonials. I was thinking this morning as I was reviewing yesterday's show how all this really is. It started to become very clear for me. All this really is, the whole first five lessons of Way of Mastery, is a practice in mindfulness. And it's probably prompted by a session I had yesterday where a 55-year-old gentleman was moaning and complaining about how hard it is to stay aware of all the different times he gets triggered, about all of the issues with his parents that are still blocking his performing optimally in his life. And I think the critical piece for me was this morning, it just kind of sank in that, you know, all these first five lessons are really talking about is being awake and aware in the moment, being mindful. That mindfulness practice that some people talk about. Understanding that most of us have been trained or conditioned into just plowing through life on autopilot and then choosing differently, choosing to be awake and aware in the moment, choosing to watch the flow of our thoughts and see their movement but refuse to be moved by them. Understand that that mechanical level of mind really isn't functional, isn't what's supposed to be driving our experience. So I'm going to turn on a microphone here and find out if we are actually being heard. Is this Susan?
Hey, so, yes, it is. And
are we
yes,
being heard?
I can hear you fine.
Okay, good, because I've had five people on the call and dropped, five different phone numbers were on the call and then dropped off. So I just thought, and they were going like one at a time. I was just wondering if we had a technical difficulty.
Not on my end, but that's
verifying.
Okay. And I have been toying with the idea of calling in, and so maybe I can do that right now if you're finished or with saying what you're saying or it's okay.
Please, say hello. What's been happening in your young life?
Well, what you've been thinking about is what I've been thinking about. And these lessons, I often listen, as you know, in the middle of the night, but all I'm seeing is how much I gave up ruminating for Lent, by the way. And of course, I'm ruminating like gangbusters and always have, but now I'm noticing it. But the great thing about this is that Way of Mastery teaches not to beat yourself up about it. That's the cutting edge for me, is to just allow it and just watch it and say, isn't that interesting? And I don't know anything. Why am I thinking I know about this? I don't know about this. And then I can come back to the moment. And the moment, like that rooted center of creation, is pure joy. And I remember feeling that as a child many times, an inexplicable excitement about life. Nothing necessarily in particular, just that it was profoundly exciting. And I can't think of any other word for it. But then I thought of how Jesus says, be like a child. And maybe that's the kind of child he's talking about, the innate. It's almost like part of our DNA is to be joyful, but it's gotten covered up. And also, you know I'm going in 10 directions here, but when you said, or Way of Mastery said, there are no ordinary moments, this redeems everything right there. So anyway, this has just been, as I've said many times, this has been a wonderful thing to have this material gone over and over and over. I don't think it would matter if you read the same lesson all year, every day, because the mind, it bores in. So,
well, that's one of the things that Michael used to say about his DVDs, and he would get comments from people on a regular basis that, you know, they're pretty sure that he's been screwing around with the DVD, because the last time they listened to it, the first five times they listened to it, they didn't hear him say this or that.
Right.
And what we know is it isn't the DVD that's changing, it's me that's changing. What we understand is I'm a new person every time I come back to reread a book I've read before, or, you know, study a great work that I was studying. I've built the brain. So this is like what we were talking about the other day about Rilke saying, in the moment when a mind can ask a really good question, that mind is incapable of comprehending the answer.
Mm-hmm.
So that mind has to grow through experience and expand and learn to be questioning and get out of the automatic, rigid thinking pattern that's been programmed into it before it can comprehend the answer to a really good question.
Yeah.
And essentially, you know, that's what was happening with me this morning when I just started to have this realization that, you know what, at a very real level, these whole first five lessons are just talking about a more refined, a more focused practice of mindfulness.
Mm.
To go through each moment of the day awake and understand that life is going to flow and unfold. I'm not creating all of that, and yet I am creating my experience of it in every moment.
Mm.
You know, it's like we're talking about how the mind energy is a creative force, and it's always on. So I'm just carelessly spraying this creative energy in all of these different directions, and then I don't like the results I'm getting by creating what I'm creating, and then I complain about it. But I'm not awake to the fact that I'm the one directing the hose. I'm the one pointing the creative energy toward what is getting created more and more and more in each moment as my experience. And the reason that's happening is because how I've been conditioned. So when I wake up to the conditioning, when I wake up to the process, and I make the choice to cultivate that present moment awareness, right? That word cultivate is used so often just in the first five lessons. And when I cultivate that practice and then allow it to bubble up through me, like this whole idea of making sure that I'm not setting 17 alarms on my smartphones to prompt me for, you know, 15 minutes every hour or 5 minutes every hour. That's not what this is about. This is about putting myself in the space, in that awake, aware space, so I stay connected to that creative energy that's always there, always whispering in my ear, and let it be, you know, a part of the decision-making process or the choice process that I make moment to moment, rather than that mechanical level of mind just churning out its stuff. Like that I made mention of earlier in this session, that, in this show, that I had a session yesterday with a 55-year-old who came in and said something, and to me it was just like he was just painting this beautiful picture of how his frustrations with not being able to satisfy his father are still running his life as a 55-year-old.
Yeah.
And blocking him from seeing how other people value and appreciate his intelligence and his work ethic. And one of the ways it could be seen is that they keep asking him to help with certain projects. Well, that's a compliment. Somebody wants my help, my assistance. I don't always have the time. I can't always say yes. But if they're asking me, that means they value my intelligence and my capabilities and my work ethic. But he could not see this as a compliment. It just immediately triggered, what I'm already doing isn't good enough?
Wow.
And that would, you know, very, very closely echo a pattern that he developed with his dad. So, you know, what wonderful changes can I implement when I become aware that it's my choice of how to interpret and respond to these events that is creating my experience of it. And then everything about the whole first five lessons is simply, let's help you, let's help each of us, let's help each other develop a practice where that awake and aware, the buzzword for it these days is mindfulness, that space of awareness and mindfulness is where we choose, actively choose to be throughout the day.
Yeah, allowing is like a kind of forgiveness. It's like an immediate forgiveness practice.
Yeah, well, you know, for me, the thing that really took my work to the next level was when I realized that I can't do allowance. I can't really do it. But what I can do is catch my resistance. So I put that mental scanning device in place to look for the earliest warnings that I'm trying to say no or wait a minute or that's not right or to whatever the flow of life is, and catch it earlier and earlier, and then breathe and soften, and now I'm in allowance.
Okay,
allowance is just being in touch with the flow of life. Resistance is the opposite of it, and I'm the one that initiates the resistance. It's like that talk about detachment. So many people get stuck in this idea of detachment. Right? And they think, I'm going to detach, and I'm going to detach from that. But that's an action. And and that's like hating somebody. I'm never going to talk to him again. If I hate somebody, I'm every bit as attached to them as if I'm passionately in love with them. And so
that's
detachment
true.
keeps me connected. So what really is detachment? I think it's similar to what we're talking about with allowance.
I think it is. I never thought of that before.
The way to look at detachment is to say, I want to scan my own processing, my thoughts moment to moment, so that I can become aware at the earliest possible times when I am attached, identified with, setting goals for things I don't have control over. And as I notice that, it falls away. When I realize that it's counterproductive, that it's causing me the aches and pains and stress and negative emotions, then I quit pouring my mental energy into staying attached. You know, Guy Finley says, hey, if a skunk walked into this auditorium, he was giving a talk, he said, if a skunk, a live skunk, walked into this auditorium tonight, would you have to work to be detached from it? No. Right? So detachment, the way people talk about it, is really another mental process. It's engaging in what David Bohm would call sustained incoherence. I create a problem in my mind by thinking, I want something to be other than the way it is. I'm attaching to this moment, and I want this moment to stay this way forever.
Mm.
Right? I'm attaching to my peace, and I don't want anybody disturbing it. And then along comes somebody that I'm judging is not so peaceful. And now there goes my peace out the window. And now I'm going to use my mental energy to try and detach from that person. I'm using more mental energy. That's sustained incoherence. That's using that flawed process of thought, creating my frustration and my resistance to the flow of life, and creating all the negative emotions that I'm experiencing. And then I just keep using that process in more and more convoluted ways until I'm exhausted and I don't like life and I'm frustrated that all of this manifestation stuff isn't working for me, et cetera. So the way to accomplish what I say I want when somebody starts talking about detachment is simply to move into observation, that noticing, that living in the present moment, that mindfulness, that scanning and watching, what is it I'm creating in this moment with my mind energy? Where am I pointing that creative force of mind energy moment to moment?
You know, all of this, you often say we're all connected. And I haven't ever had a sense of that as much as I have a sense of it now when I'm aware that everything around me causes, I mean, it doesn't cause, but I am influenced by whatever is going on around me, which is a kind of connection. And a lot of the connections, if they're not pleasant, that's my work to do, but somehow I feel as if I'm coming to the idea of connectedness from a very negative angle, but it's still an angle. At least it's a toehold.
Yeah, that's what we have to do with it. We have to play with these concepts in an action in our lives. We can't just play with the words and the thoughts. This is the right there in the first lesson. It told us, look, the way of the master, the way of the heart, this whole way of the heart first lesson is not about your intellect. Your intellect is just this very simple, very, Guy Finley calls it a mechanical level of consciousness. It just keeps churning. It's like the hamster on the wheel. It just keeps doing what's been programmed into it. In a later lesson, The Way of Mastery talks about how your intellect can only churn up the garbage that's been thrown into it, like a garbage can. Right? And you've been conditioned from, as Michael Rice would say, you know, generations of trauma with generations of brains with faulty software or, you know, viruses in the software, and it just keeps getting passed down. Somebody has to step in and say, wait a minute, I need a virus removal tool. I need to clean up the hard drive. I need to undo the negative conditioning that has me constantly creating all of these negative emotions and then blaming it on somebody else. The intellect can't do that. The Way of Mastery was very clear in an earlier lesson where it said, all the intellect can do is start to notice all the garbage that's in it.
Yeah.
Right? It can just be this guidance, or not guidance system, this alarm system, when it churns up a bunch of garbage, and it can notice, oh, I've done this a lot before. I'm still doing it now. Okay, well, let me just take a break from doing that and take a breath and ask something else to step in. What's that something else? In this work, they call it the awakened heart. That's an energetic, experiential process. It's not something you can talk about.
You know what I love about the Way of Mastery, too, is Michael said some days ago and reminded us that another name for Satan is the resistor. But the Way of Mastery doesn't talk about, yeah, the Way of Mastery doesn't do that because I imagine because the Way of Mastery isn't into judgment of any kind or labeling of any kind. But most of us, I think, when we find ourselves in resistance, feel as if we're, you know, we're dancing with the devil. We're being evil. We have evil in us. And I love the idea of being able to, I mean, I've had to say no to some things. One thing Michael really cares about is still point breathing, and he gets so much out of it, and others seem to too. But I haven't been able to do it, and I am in resistance to it, and I'm just hoping that I can find my way to enlightenment without doing still point breathing, but to call it, you know.
I'll hold that hope with you.
Thank you. I just plain stink at it, and I'm very self-conscious, and I think, well, I could go to battle on this one, but I feel as if it's like wheel spinning. Why don't I just put on my tire chains and drive slowly away into better territory for me? But, you know, he's this genius who's got these tools, and if somebody doesn't use a tool, it must be very frustrating. I remember having a client who did very well using the wake-up sheet until suddenly she said, this isn't working, I don't like it. And she eventually quit, and I was mad at her. And then I thought, wait a minute, wait. First of all, what the hell?
Well,
you know, I got to do
in the first place, you weren't mad at her. If Michael were on the call, he'd say, that's the denial that's talked about in Lesson 3 of the Way of Mastery.
Right.
In the minute you think your anger is caused by what she did,
yep.
Right. Because
exactly.
In that moment, you're in denial of the first axiom. Do you remember the first axiom from page 5 in the Way of Mastery? It says, "You only experience the results of your choices."
Right. Yep.
Right. It's right there in the fifth page. Nothing that you experience is caused by anything outside of you. And then in lesson 3, it says, "Denial." Denial of that first axiom immediately causes projection, instantaneously. No time gap noticeable.
Right.
So
you're
instantly
in it.
When I think I didn't do this, my mind shows me a picture of my friend causing my anger.
Yeah. Well, right.
So if I want out of that loop, if I don't like my anger, I have to start at the beginning, which is to say, oh, I'm feeling anger. how am I creating this anger?
Mm-hmm.
And as I
That's
see
Friedrich
it...
That's Friedrich Walzak.
Fully, clearly, then the cessation of the anger is automatic. Because I simply quit engaging in the process that was creating the thing I say I don't want.
Right.
It's that easy. And again, the conscious logical mind refuses to think it's that easy.
It's very, very basic, and it has to be constant. It's like constant vigilance, like noticing every breath. Otherwise,
yeah, it's a,
for me,
fundamentally, it's mindfulness.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Wow.
It's just,
you know,
it's just a very specific level of practice and cultivating mindfulness with a few guidance points. Right? Instead of just saying, take a moment and be aware of your breath, this is, in each new present moment, understand you're the one creating your experience.
Mm-hmm. Right. So you have always encouraged callers to call in, but with this material, it's hard to find the words. You get us to a place where words aren't very easily accessed. So I love it that you're reading right straight through, but I imagine you understand that that's part of the issue here, is that you get us into a state and then you say, anybody have any questions? And I'm thinking, let me dredge up my conscious logical mind here. You know, like what you're talking about, you think about it in the morning and then you come on the radio show and you say, I had these thoughts. Well, that's how it is for, I bet many of us, it is for me, is I have the thoughts way after the material has gone in there. So it's a challenge to be a radio show person in this circumstance.
Well, this particular process makes it far easier.
Yeah, I can understand that.
Right. Because
if I wasn't working
through the Way of Mastery, reading the whole thing,
yeah.
If I was, like with the Course in Miracles lessons, that
mm-hmm.
maybe take 5 or 10 minutes in the beginning of the show. And then then I have to try and figure out what to talk about. You know, which of Michael's tools should we talk about today? Which of the things that's happened in a patient session might be relevant? But
mm-hmm.
this makes it far easier. So it's much more fluid for me to use
mm-hmm.
almost the entire hour when I'm reading a lesson.
Yeah. I'm glad.
I just want to make sure that in that process, I'm offering the chance. And I'm trying to strike this balance between offering the chance and having a lot of dead air space, because we've got really good material to fill the airspace, right? If nobody has a question, then fine.
Well,
I'll keep going back over the lesson, which is a life-changing
mm-hmm.
set of tools in my personal experience.
Mm-hmm. Yes, it is. Totally it is. I was thinking if, you know, how people will ask you, if you could take one book with you onto an island that you were going to be marooned on for the rest of your life, I would take The Way of Mastery. A lot of people say the Bible.
That.
Yeah. I wish I were, as my daughter is a wonderful preacher, and she finds this richness and these truths in the Bible, in her studies. She is able to breathe the air back into the words on the page in a way I never have been able to do. And at one point she said, Mom, why don't you just read the Bible? And I say, because I don't have that gift. It's a gift you have. And if I had that gift, I probably wouldn't need The Way of Mastery. But I need this. And she's okay, but she had to ask me because she thinks I'm taking chewed over contents. And that's one way of looking at it, I guess, but it doesn't feel chewed over at all. It feels as if the words are coming through for us now, and we don't have to work as hard as she works. And I don't know if she works hard, though. She just will read something, and she'll see something in a sentence that I've read that sentence so many times. You know, when you were brought up in a religion, as a Catholic, I wasn't, but I became involved in a very, I won't go into it, but a fundamentalist church that did a lot of good and a lot of damage, and I was exposed to scripture all the time throughout my teens and into my 20s and had to leave finally. But it had a deadening effect on me. Reading the Bible was like, I wanted to get away from it. It was like PTSD every time I opened the book. So the Way of Mastery is a huge gift.
Yeah, I think that's probably why in our world there are so many different messages, scriptures, etc. Because we, you know, each of us resonates differently with them.
Mm-hmm.
I know people that really, really swim in the Course in Miracles.
Right.
And they say, oh, what do you mean it's difficult? It's just so clear. It's just so direct. And that wasn't my experience of it.
Mm-hmm.
It's okay that it's good for them. It's, you know, I am so grateful that they have something that they find of value. As I'm
I often
grateful
wonder
that I have those tools that resonate for me. You often wonder what?
For me, whether the Course in Miracles laid the groundwork for being able to love the Way of Mastery as much as I do. I've always thought of it as sort of another step, not even necessarily up, just a more compatible step.
I think essentially, and I've said it over and over again, it's just a kinder, gentler version of the very same message.
Mm. Yeah, and you probably, you spent a lot of years on the way of on the Course in Miracles, right, or not?
No, I was first introduced to the Course in Miracles through Michael's work. And Michael would occasionally make reference to it, and he had a lecture titled Course in Miracles, A New Beginning. And he had a lecture, Course in Miracles, What is the World? And that was my introduction. And then and I would have people from, I would get into the, you know, back into 2004, Right before I got introduced to Michael's work, 2002 or something like that, I started getting introduced to the Unity and the Unitarian Universalist Church and the Religious Science Church and the Christian Science Church by probably 2006. So that, you know, that, those various bodies of teachings that were all so similar kind of tilled the soil for me so that when Michael came along with the Course in Miracles, it made perfect sense.
Mm.
And I listened multiple times, numerous multiple times to those two lessons because when I first started the Mind Shifter support groups, all we did was Michael's videos. And we would show an hour of one video each week and then have an hour and a half of processing and worksheets and discussion. And so it would take 2 weeks to get through one video, and he had like 14 videos. So we'd make it through each video twice every year. And, you know, that group was running probably for the better part of 8 years before we started introducing things other than Michael's work.
Wow.
So digging into the Course in Miracles a little bit through Michael's teachings and those two lessons, and eventually I got a copy of it, and it did not resonate with me. It was just too many double, triple negatives, too much talking
right.
about vulnerability and invulnerability. But over time, I learned, because I had, you know, really resonated with and really poured myself into the way of mastery, over time I learned, oh, when they talk about vulnerability, I can read right through that and just use the word open.
Mm-hmm.
Be open. Openness.
Yeah.
Complete, wide open. And invulnerability
mm-hmm.
means when I read that in that, I just say perfect safety.
Mm,
because what they're talking
so...
about is my perfect safety.
Mm-hmm.
I cannot be hurt. My essence can't be destroyed. It talks about it in the opening of the Course in Miracles. It says, what's true can't be hurt or destroyed, and what's not true doesn't exist. Well, if you're
mm-hmm.
here, if you've got awareness, if you have an essence, if you have a soul, call it what you will, it can't be hurt or destroyed. So because of the tilling of the soil with, you know, Michael's two lectures and then the smattering of my attempts to read into the Course in Miracles that just didn't resonate with me, and then the deep, deep dive with the Way of Mastery
mm-hmm.
talking, and then the darshans from the Way of Mastery, which was, you know, hundreds of hours of listening to basically the kind of thing that's happening now on this internet show when we're going through reading the Way of Mastery with commentary.
Mm.
And so now when I read the Course in Miracles, I can substitute, you know, simple, direct, what Michael would call good regulatory speech statements for a lot of that poor regulatory speech, double, triple negatives, you know, invulnerability,
yeah.
et cetera.
Mm.
So it is beyond words good for me, and so I am delighted that, you know, seemingly more people are listening to this first hour since this year started, and we've started the Way of Mastery, so apparently it's resonating with people.
That's
more
so great.
Than the show was before that, so I'll just keep doing it and enjoy it.
Good. Have you ever thought of doing the darshans? You say this is like the darshans. I haven't listened to the darshans.
This is a darshan.
You know,
that's what this is.
Yeah. Okay.
I mean, essentially, in the darshans, Jayam would sit in his ashram in Bali, and he would have anywhere from 5 to 8 or 10 people lying around on cushions in the room, and he'd sit there in his, you know, folded leg position and just talk for an hour, roughly an hour for each session.
And these weren't channelings. Right.
This is him talking about the work that is the Way of Mastery.
Okay.
So he took, I believe it was every week. It was, you know, it ran from 2011 to 2014, so that's quite a while ago, and I don't remember exactly how it went. But I paid for it, and I would get on quite a few of them. I would get on that, I think it was a Saturday, and I would be on the internet and I would watch it. And if I missed them, or if I'd watched it and I wanted to save and download it, I could download it to my computer. And then at the turn of the month, because they had limited computer space, you only had a few days to go back and download the ones from the month, and then they were gone. So I don't have all of them, but I have a lot. I have a lot. And there were 75 sessions. Most of them were an hour, some a little less, some a little more. 75 sessions just on the first 12 lessons.
Wow.
And so it's basically, I heard something recently that somebody said they're going to be making those available for people for free, like on Christmind.info or whatever.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. Wow.
But I don't know that they're going to make that available for free. I don't know because, you know, originally they had people paying for them.
Mm-hmm.
But I have heard people say that on YouTube they have found more and more of those snippets. Not the whole darshan, but, you know, if you go to JM's YouTube channel, you know, go to YouTube and search for JM.
Okay.
Then as you scroll down, there are all kinds of things I've been told that are excerpts from the darshans.
Hmm.
Yeah, if you just type in JM Hammer darshans, you know, there's 13 and 14 and 15-minute snippets. But each of those are in 3 and 4 minute snippets, but each of them was about an hour long.
Oh, well.
So someone told me, you know, someone who's been following that told me that they heard that the darshans are going to get uploaded somewhere so that people can have access to them. But that's essentially what we're doing here. We're simply going slowly, reading. And in the darshans, because I would sit there with the book.
Yeah.
And JM was sitting there with a different book, something that was slightly different. Every once in a while, the word. So he might have had, you know, the original transcripts before they got published.
Right.
But the difference is he was not simply reading through every word in the lesson. And he wasn't going back the way I am. He would go off on more tangential riffs than I do.
Mm.
And so he would skip whole sections that he didn't feel were, you know, worth his time or trying to, you know, helping him communicate the critical point he wanted to communicate. And what I'm doing is I'm just, you know, I'm trying to make sure that I'm reading it verbatim at least once before I start rewording it. And although I said at the beginning, I'm going to substitute the creator or creation for these references for the word God, et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
But beyond that, you know, the only other change I think I've consistently made is to talk about extending the love that you are rather than loving someone.
Well, that's another whole topic, Dr. Kim. I've been thinking about that you never loved anybody thing when I'm just adoring and loving on my favorite cat, for instance. And the allowing and permissions in Way of Mastery is so delicious because I can say, okay, it's okay. What I'm doing is just what I'm doing right now because that's the way I am. And I'm aware that it may not be everything, but the judgment, that's it. The judgment is being extracted from the whole picture. So it's just, I'm just watching what I do. And I can't imagine loving every cat in the world the way I love this cat. But it used to bother me. And now it's just what it is. So the whole business of you never loved anybody, and I understand what Michael's trying to say. I think I do, but I can't fuss about that one too much. And that's probably pretty much the story of my life. There's so much that flows through. It's the mindfulness thing again, over and over just watching.
And it's the fussing about it. Right?
Yeah.
I mean, as you listen to the Way of Mastery just in the first, four lessons, and just in the first three it says, hey, look, play in the kingdom. Keep it light.
Mm-hmm.
Laugh.
That's
dance,
wonderful.
Sing. Don't let seriousness enter the mind. Remember that line?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Don't let seriousness enter your mind. Judgment is a poison, but don't worry about it because you can't be hurt by poison. Right? The essence of who you are can't be hurt. So sing, dance, play in the kingdom. So, the fussing about it, the judgment that you let in is something you can notice and then release. You can choose not to pour your mind energy into it.
Mm-hmm. That's pretty much the exercise over and over and over and over. Yeah.
And that, again, that begs into what I've tried to highlight through this work is that this body of work is not about following Michael or J.M. or Jesus, or it's not about following somebody. It's about waking up to the actuality that the essence, the teacher, life, love is your inheritance.
Mm-hmm.
And you're here, in essence, you're having a physical experience so that you can express what this energy of creation wants to express uniquely through you in each moment. So one of the primary effects of doing work like this is you recognize where you have become attached to a teacher or a guru or a master or a priest or even a set of teachings, and you learn to put it down.
Yeah.
So then when your teacher says, you shouldn't do that, you shouldn't say you love this person, you just kind of chuckle and say, okay, maybe that's good for you. Bless your heart. And then you talk about, love you, and 'cause you can have both levels of comprehension. You can understand that you are this energy of creation that some would call love, and that essentially what you're doing when you're interacting with someone from a compassionate basis and a gratitude basis and a cherishing basis is extending the energy that you are and meshing with the energy that they are, and that's fine.
Mm-hmm. No, it's been just great having those challenges to hear those things and then learn how to take them in without making them into judgments and getting all fussed up about it. Just just noticing. I love the way you said ages ago, that's really impressed me. You said something, your response was, oh, okay. I can't think of the example you gave, but okay, you want to do it that way? That's okay, good.
Right.
That extends to just everything.
Exactly. It's the flow of life. And that's what, this lesson is from lesson five, the first four keys to the kingdom are about learning to be mindful of how it's okay. It's all okay. It's all just life. And life has to be okay. Well, you've done it again. You've helped us get right near the end of our first hour. So thank you.
Wow.
I'm going to There's about 5 minutes left, but I'm going to look at the text I got from Jeannie about the message or the show she wants me to play, since they aren't going to be able to be here. And so it's Laws of Living, and I'm going to scroll down and find where that is so I can start that.
How do you do that, Dr. Tim? Do you run it all from your office? You have the same switchboard, or?
Yeah. Yeah, wherever you are, when you have the password, you can tap into the switchboard. And so we're ready to go.
Great.
Any closing words? Any closing gifts you want to give us? All right.
No.
Well, thank you.
Okay. Thanks,
I've been working to try and get caught up on putting up the files on the MindShiftersAcademy.org page. So
yeah.
If you notice that one is missing, please shoot me a message. But I stayed extra late last night trying to get some of those edited and uploaded.
Oh, that's awfully good of you. Well, the great thing is if one's missing, you can just listen to another one and you get your infusion. But, yeah, I'll pay attention.
All right. Well, blessings. Thanks again for the call. I will mute you and look forward to the next time we get to chat.
Thanks, Dr. Tim.
So the second hour today will be a replay of the Laws of Living. I will remind us all that we come from love. We're made of this stuff we call love. We actually are love, and everything else is false. Welcome to the second hour.
Welcome to our workshop, Laws of Living. Tonight we're going to look into what are some of the identifiable laws by which we can manage our minds and our lives. And as we do that, what might be some of the results? And if we're not familiar with the laws, what might that look like? And so I'm going to start off with a question, and my question is, and I'm going to invite everybody in our audience to think about it, because we'll refer back to this question often, everyone on the video as well, is that have you ever done anything in your life that today you regret having done? Anybody ever done anything that you regret? Okay, several smiles and some yeses in the group. All right. Well, I'd like you to, if you would, pick a specific situation where you did something that today you now regret. And as you think about that situation, what I'm going to ask you to do is go back and identify specifically what you were feeling at the time that event happened. So what were you feeling? So take a minute, take a couple of deep breaths, and just go back to one of those scenarios that today you go, oh man, I wish I hadn't done that one. What were you feeling? Okay? And if you would put a word to that feeling, and then I'm going to ask you to share with us, some of the people from the audience, if you would share with us, what were you feeling when you did that which today you now regret? Anyone?
Disconnected.
Disconnected, okay.
Fear.
Fear.
Shame.
Uncontrolled. Shame.
Arrogant.
Arrogant. Okay, so the thing I'd like to everyone to notice is that nobody, and I've asked this question of tens of thousands of people over the years, the answer, loving, never comes up. Why do you suppose that is? I would offer that in order to properly manage our minds, there are laws for doing so. The law does not call for a negative state of mind when you want to make an important choice. It calls for something much different. And we're going to look into what that law calls for in making choices. And notice that when there's another feeling happening within you, when there's something else going on, that you are guided by your own mind to make choices which are oftentimes against your own will and choice. The reason for that is that you're not making a choice at all, you're making a decision, and decisions are automatic. They're stored within us, they come forward automatically, and if they come forward with enough emotion, they rob us of choice and intelligence. So note what you were feeling, and then one more place to go with that is, Why did you do what you did? Look back, take a moment and think about it. And I'm going to ask for some input from the audience. What, why did you do that which you did? Anyone have an answer for that? Why did you do it?
Maybe an assessment that was inaccurate.
Okay, an inaccurate assessment. Okay, anyone else? Why did you do what you did when you that thing which you now regret? Go for it.
I'm not sure. I was tired.
Tired. Okay. Anyone else? Why did you do?
I put fear into somebody else.
You wanted to put fear into someone? Okay.
I wasn't thinking.
You weren't thinking. Okay.
I wasn't quite sure. I mean, I said I was tired, but I don't think that describes it. I'm not quite sure what to say. It's kind of like I was just emotionally removed from the situation.
You were emotionally removed from the situation.
Well, that explains
okay. I think that says something about it. Mm-hmm. Okay.
I lashed out when I wasn't really angry at that person. It was totally somebody, something else.
Huh? Okay, so you lashed out at someone, and afterward discovered it was really about someone else. It wasn't even about the person you lashed out at. Okay. So you were carrying some anger from another situation is the why of it. Okay. Great. Anyone else? Kind of input on that?
Well, I was just going to say, I think I was feeling needy and had such a need to connect.
Uh-huh.
It clouded any, I mean, it just completely destroyed my life.
Okay. Feeling needy and that need to connect destroyed your judgment is how you'd see it now. Okay, great. Well, that's some good input. I've got a different answer than any of those answers for why you did what you did. And I would offer that you did what you did for only one reason. And it's the same reason for every one of us when we do that which we now regret. And the reason why you did what you did that you now regret is because you had a reality in your mind that guided you to do it. Now, I would offer that reality is the output of the human mind. Reality is not what's going on out there in the world. When you look through your eyes, you are looking at reality. You are looking at what's happening between your ears. Actuality is what's happening out in the world. Now, let's say that there's a certain circumstance or situation, and we say, well, no, really, it was that situation that caused me to do that. Well, if that particular situation were the cause of you doing what you did, and that happened in the room right now in front of all of us, we'd all do that exact same thing. But that situation becomes the trigger for a reality that you hold in your mind. And notice where you have emotions that are unlike love attached to a reality. When something resonates that reality, it takes over your behavior. You know, how often do we open our mouths just to change feet and afterward go, oh my God, why did I do that? So in each case, you had a reality that guided that behavior, and behind that reality was a goal. One of the laws of the mind is that in order for a reality to come forward, in order for your mind to bring forward a reality that guides your behavior, there's got to be a goal that drives that behavior. And to start to identify the goals that drive that behavior, and we spend a lot more time in this in our workshop, Getting the Stress You Need, and in our Laws of Living course, when we do a 14-day intensive, we do this course. This is sort of an outtake, along with the Getting the Stress You Need, from our Laws of Living course. But as you recognize that those goals drive your behavior, and your behavior is driven by the realities you hold, then it becomes imperative to start to understand what goals you're holding. And if they're hidden or unconscious goals, it's time to wake up to them, and as you become aware of them and in touch with them, you have the opportunity to change them. And that's the only way you'll ever change that behavior. You know, the person who says, and how many, having done that behavior that you now regret, have done it more than once in your life? Yeah, here we are. We're human. And notice how many times when you've done that behavior in the past, you said, and that's it, I'm never going to do that one again. And notice that you didn't do that one again until somebody gave you the look and triggered that behavior-driving reality in you. So we do those things because we hold those realities in our minds, and we each have a personal code. We each have our own unconscious set of rules by which we govern our behavior. So you have a set of laws in you, a set of rules for governing your behavior. In certain circumstances, you do certain things. In those same circumstances, I would do something different because I have different rules for governing my behavior. The person sitting next to you in that same circumstance would do something different again because they have still a different set of rules, a different personal code. So you have a personal code, I have a personal code. And our personal code determines our behavior. And so one of the things that we're going to look at in our laws of living is, where does our personal code come from? Did you make up your personal code? Did you sit down one day and say, well, gee, I think what I'll do the next time somebody gives me the look is go into a fit of rage and smash something? Did you sit down and figure that out? No. But it's in your mind, if that's the behavior you did when you wish you hadn't done it. And so it becomes imperative to start to look at our personal code and to see where it's come from. Many of the items in our personal code come to us genetically. Literally, this body-mind unit is an energy system, and this energy system stores information. It's designed to store every frequency that comes into it. And anything that impacts your senses comes via a frequency. So this is a device that registers information. And the information is registered in every cell in the structure, including the sperm and the egg. So were you to conceive a child tomorrow, that child would have in its structure every thought you've ever thought, every feeling you've ever felt, every reality you've ever engaged in, every behavior you've ever done. And oftentimes what you'll find is that the behavior-driving reality was inherited from a previous generation. That part of your personal code came from that previous generation. In fact, if you look into the Aramaic in the Old Testament, where they understood, well, old and new, but in Aramaic, they understood the laws by which life operates. They understood the laws by which the mind, the body, our emotions, our relationships, our finances, all aspects of life work. In that language, they said, look to the lives of the fathers, for ours are but a shadow of theirs upon the earth. In other words, a lot of our personal code came from our interaction with our fathers and from our genetic receiving from our fathers and, of course, from our mothers, from the previous generations. You look at that word generation, and the root of it is genari, which means cause. Many aspects of our personal code have come from our environment. You know, you take a kid and you put in an environment where there's a lot of fighting, there's a lot of conflict, there's a lot of strife, and you've got a kid who's probably going to respond with a personal code that functions in harmony with that. A kid that's probably going to be a lot readier to raise a fist than the one who's brought up in an environment where people are able to talk things through and work things through and create a safe, supportive, and nurturing space. So the environment has a great deal of impact upon our personal code. Our friends. The television set today is a very powerful influence, especially on children's personal codes. And while the excuse is given by the media, oh, the kids know the difference between a real and an imagined situation on the screen, yes, they do, but the child who doesn't have in their personal code that a certain behavior is acceptable will never do that behavior. But if they watch the tube over and over and over again, and they build the brain cells that say, this behavior is normal for a person like me, this behavior is acceptable, or this behavior will get me some rewards, then having built the brain cells for that behavior, it is more likely to become a part of their personal code. Our religious leaders oftentimes determine our personal code or have a great deal of input into the realities that we build that become part of our personal code. Political figures, the whole external world. Now, if you look back 2,000 years ago, there was a warning that was given about allowing the world to form your personal code. And that warning that was given went like this, and you might remember this from the scriptures, do not be molded by the world, or you will end up moldy. Remember that quote? Okay, it didn't exactly go like that, but that's essentially the message. That if we buy into the world's way of doing things, we are going to integrate into our system disintegrative energies. When you start to look at this body-mind unit as an energy system, there are only two qualities relative to it. There's integrative, what builds it up, and disintegrative, what tears it down. Where you put a disintegrative energy, you begin the disintegrative process. And the world specializes. The world gathers those disintegrative energies and feeds them right into us. Why do they tend to gather those energies? Because those energies have a lot of emotional content around them. And you look at that word emotion, it's energy in motion. So there's a tendency to keep and hold on to that which generates a lot of energy. And if you don't know how to go in and change those energies in the system, and in the Aramaic language, the definition of changing those energies in the system was forgiveness, if you don't know how to do that, then that energy will simply perpetuate itself and carry on. Now, there is another personal code available to us. And that is a personal code that is lawful. And it's interesting how law has been given kind of a bad rap in our culture today. You know, you hear the kids referring to the law as pigs. What kind of speech, and we're going to look a little later at speech and how it impacts our minds and our personal codes, but you look at that kind of speech and you see the kind of reputation that law has, and unfortunately oftentimes deserved because of the way it behaves, because of the personal code of those who are in. And it's interesting that we now have this thing called law enforcement in our culture. We didn't used to have law enforcement. We used to have peace officers. Big change. You shift from law to authority. And when you shift from law to authority, law becomes the rules of a superior. And of course, in our culture, who's the superior? Well, people tend to think it's the guy with the biggest gun. And so they become the law. You know, how often in the Westerns did we see somebody who came into town with the biggest and the fastest gun, and they said, well, he became the law of that town. Well, I'd offer that isn't law. And to put forward what men do and what men pass in their legislatures as laws is a great disservice to the law. There are laws by which life operates. There are laws by which this energy system operates, and the awareness and the knowledge of those laws allows us to function within that system. Example, let's imagine that you've just built a beautiful new home, and you had my great-grandmother wire it for you. Okay? Now, today's the day when we're going to turn the power on. How many of you want to sleep in this house tonight? Not very likely. Why not? Because my great-grandmother doesn't know any of the laws of wiring a house, any of the laws of electricity. Chances are there's going to be big trouble if someone who doesn't understand the lawful process by which it's operated, that there's going to be problems. It is understanding the law that allows us to function within a structure. And man's way of interpreting the law would present the opposite, that law is a way of restricting. Law is actually the key to liberty within the real energy system. In understanding how the laws operate, one is free to move about and utilize those laws correctly. No understanding of the law will lead to problems. So there is a personal code that is available to us if we choose to use it. And it's a personal code that comes direct from the Creator. And as you recognize that personal code is actually already written within you, then accessing it becomes a major key. Now, what does our personal code have to do with what happens in our lives? Well, it determines every behavior. So our behaviors either go in harmony with the laws of living, or they fall out of harmony with the laws of living, which leads to difficulty. Back in, let's see, what was the date? 1758. There was a gentleman named Sir William Blackstone. Blackstone is considered, even today yet, one of England's greatest legal scholars. And I'd like to read a quote from Sir William Blackstone. He said this in his Oxford lectures on the nature of law, and as he described the eternal laws of life. He said, "For he, capital He, the Creator, has so intimately connected the laws with the happiness of each individual that the latter cannot be attained, that is, happiness cannot be obtained, but by observing the former, the laws. And if the former be obeyed, that is, if the laws be obeyed, it cannot but induce the latter, happiness." There's what Blackstone said a couple of hundred years ago, understanding how this energy system called life works. If you look at the man named Jesus, you find that in our culture, Jesus is presented as a law, as a religious figure. But when you go back into his Aramaic language and his Aramaic teachings, he's not a religious figure. He doesn't say, "I come not to destroy religion." What did he say? "I come not to destroy the law." His forte was understanding the laws by which this energy system operates. He spoke in a language called Aramaic, and it is absolutely necessary to come to an understanding of the Aramaic to understand what he said. And unfortunately, in this culture, most of what we get to see comes out of Greek translations. And you can't speak Jesus' law in Greek. It's just not possible. Why not? Well, let's think of an example. And there's as much difference in these two situations as there is between the Aramaic and the Greek language. Let's imagine that we go to the jungles of South America. We're out in the middle of the rainforest. And there's a man who has never been maybe more than 25 miles from his native village deep in the jungles. He doesn't know what's going on in the world or that there's a world out there perhaps. But he knows his world very well. And imagine that he's out on a hunting expedition, and off in the distance, he's maybe 20 miles from home, and off in the distance he hears this loud roaring noise. He listens, and he follows the noise. He gets to the edge of a clearing where he sees this unbelievably huge yellow animal with very large round legs. And this animal is rolling back and forth in the forest, wiping out trees left, right, and center, just clearing it out. Now, he's really quite amazed and wowed at this. And as he watches, this animal stops, and another huge yellow animal that's spewing smoke and fire comes through the clearing and spits out this black, he doesn't know what it is. It smokes, it stinks, it's really yucky stuff. But he watches as this thing spews out this black something and spreads it over this whole area. Then still another large animal with huge round legs front and back comes and rolls back and forth and back and forth until there's this totally flat surface, one like he's never seen except in some shale rock. Now he is just amazed as he watches this happen over a period of days. He's mesmerized by it. And then these animals go away, and he hears this roaring, thunderous noise in the sky. It's just, and he looks up, and there's this bright, shining, huge bird that comes in and lands where these yellow machines, where these yellow animals have been working. Now, this bird is like no other bird he's ever seen. Its mouth is not in the front, like every other bird he's ever seen. Its mouth is on the side. And it opens its mouth and it spits out live people. I mean, he is flabbergasted. This is unbelievable. And then it eats more people and it flies away. Now, you and I know what he's observed, don't we? We understand quite well what he's observed. We have the brain cells for what he's observed. But imagine that our friend, having observed all of that, sneaks away to his jungle village. Can he go back to his friends in the jungle and say one true or meaningful word about what he has experienced? Can he say anything? True. I mean, he says he saw a bird. Did he see a bird? No, he saw an airplane. He says the bird has a mouth on the side. Does the bird have a mouth on the side? No, it doesn't have a mouth. It isn't a bird. There's a set of steps. There's a doorway that opens. Does it eat people? No. People get inside the airplane. They get off the airplane. It doesn't spit them out. He can't say anything true or meaningful about his experience because he has no brain cells for what's just happened. There is no information stored in his reality structure that would bring forward anything accurate about what he's experienced. Now, in the ancient Aramaic language, having the brain cells for something was said that you had the eyes to see and the ears to hear. You remember this man named Jesus said, those having eyes, yet they do not see, and having ears, do not hear. Now, I think we could probably safely assume that pretty much everybody in the audience had eyes and ears. Physical eyes and ears. Why couldn't they see or hear what he was saying? Because they didn't have the brain cells for it. And even to those who understood his cultural meaning, who understood his language, as he spoke to them, he said, there are so many things I want to say to you, but you can't hear them yet. In other words, you don't have the brain cells for them. And his inner teaching, his higher teaching, was only for those who had the eyes to see and the ears to hear. Now, let's go back to our jungle example. The man who is going to go back to his village, what are we going to have to do if he's going to be able to even speak one accurate, true word about what he's experienced? We're going to have to help him to build, teach him, and have him build the brain cells for what an airplane means and what international travel means. And okay, let's imagine that we've gone through that process. He now comprehends fully what that means. Can he go back to his native village and say one true or meaningful word about what he's experienced? I'd offer that even if he has the eyes to see and the ears to hear, the brain cells, he still can say nothing true or meaningful about what he's experienced to those others back in the jungle. Because they would have to have the eyes to see and the ears to hear to be able to hear him. They would have to build the brain cells to hear what he's saying as well. So sounds don't have meanings. Law of the mind. Sounds don't have meanings. Brain cells have meanings. Sounds trigger brain cells. And so we see what we have the eyes to see. We hear what we have the ears to hear. Now, let's take a look at the Aramaic and the Greek. First of all, has anybody here ever had a couple of friends who say maybe speak French or German or Italian? And you've been having a conversation with them, and one of them maybe is their language is a little bit halting as they speak English. And in their conversation, their friend is with them, and they're trying to explain something to you in English, and they can't quite find the right word. Have you ever had that happen? And so they turn to their friend who speaks both languages perhaps better than they do and say, well, how do you say, and in their native language, they say, how do you say this in English? And the person that they're talking to shakes their head and says, You can't say that in English. Why not? It's because there aren't the brain cells. The experience isn't in the English language, so there aren't words in the English language for that. Now, let's look at the Greek culture as it stood 2,000 years ago. There was this pantheon of gods, some pretty horrific beings. These were beings who raped their own children, who killed their mothers, who killed their fathers, who on a whim killed the spouse of someone else because they wanted that spouse. pretty intense group of gods, and all external out there. Now, you look at the mindset of that culture, and then you go back to the Aramaic culture, and in the Aramaic language, we have a man named Jesus who speaks about not a god out there, not one of the horrific pantheon, but rather speaks of a god called love. And a god that resides within him and within you. A god whose good pleasure it is to give you the kingdom. A god who governs not in anger and rage, but rather governs by law. Says, here, folks, here's how the system works. You have a choice. I would love to bring you everything you want. In fact, if you just ask me, I'll bring it to you. That's the law of the mind. If you put into your mind strongly enough the vibration of a request, the Creator, the Father within, will provide that for you. Now, you'll notice it doesn't say, ask for wonderful things and that's all you'll get. It just says, ask. You can ask for any quality of experience in life and you will get it. The Creator won't interfere. The Creator will just bring about the result. The Creator will so arrange circumstances that that result shows up in your life. Because the Creator has told you, I form a contract with you, and I will agree to abide by this contract. And the contract says, you ask me, and I'll give it to you. Which, of course, means if we've received something, it's because we've asked for it. Of course, the question becomes, how did I ask for this? If I asked for this out of my genetic past, out of the lives of the fathers, if I ask for this, if I set a vibration in my mind, the structure through which that creative process happens is very impersonal. It is no respecter of persons, we're told scripturally. And not being a respecter of persons, it simply agrees to bring you whatever you ask for. So all you have to do is put across your mind a request. And if in regard to that circumstance, that request is the strongest frequency within you, that circumstance will come about in your life. So here we've got a man who teaches us that. The Father within does the works. Ask and you will receive. Knock and it shall be opened to you. Now, how well do you suppose we could take the teachings of a man who says that about God and translate them into a culture who has this pantheon of fearsome, murderous gods? Not going to translate very well. In fact, the person listening in Greek can only listen to the brain cells that fire in them. Just like the native in the jungle can look at this thing, and the only brain cells that fire in him are, this is a huge bird. In the night, he snuck up to it, and he touched it. It had no feathers. Its skin was hard like a rock. He could only comprehend it in terms of that which he had the brain cells for. And so when the teachings of this man in Aramaic went to the Greek language, it could only be understood in terms of what was in that cultural mind. So now, what are most people sitting around waiting for? This horrific God to come and get them? This God named love? Something doesn't make sense here. You cannot translate the teachings of the man named Jesus out of his native Aramaic meanings into the Greek language and culture. It doesn't fit there. Any more than our friend from the jungles can go back home and talk about what he's experienced with the airplane. So as you recognize that, it's necessary to go back to that Aramaic understanding to understand, to start to comprehend and grasp what was being said. to grasp what those laws were about. And they weren't about theology, and they weren't about religion. They were about how you and I can manage our lives and how the energy system around us works. And when they've translated, you know, him saying, I come not to destroy the law, but to fulfill it. It's not what he said in Aramaic. What he said is, I come not to destroy the law, but to add unto it. In other words, the Creator came, there was a certain level of understanding about how the system worked 2,000 years ago. And he came with a much greater comprehension. And he said, I'm coming to show you a whole other level of how the system works. And if you're willing to become a student of that process, then you will gradually build the brain cells. Go back into the Aramaic language and you hear the Creator talking about how those brain cells will be built. And what he says is, strength to strength. Here a little, there a little, with stammering lips and another tongue will I speak to you. Now, why would God speak with stammering lips and another tongue to us? Could it be because we have brain cells that have been built out of such a foreign mindset that to us, the speaking of the Creator called love sounds like stammering lips and a foreign tongue? I would offer that's exactly why. It's not that the Creator's speaking in stammering lips. We're listening with brain cells that don't comprehend because we have been ingrained by the world's laws. And so when you did what you did in that opening question where you did something that you now regret, you had a personal code that was out of harmony. Why, well, again, we're back to the question, why did you do that? You did that because you had a personal code that was out of harmony with the first law for governing the mind. And if you don't understand the first law for governing the mind, you might as well forget all the rest. Because the study of the rest will gain you nothing until the first one's in place. Without it, nothing else makes sense. So what is the first law? Let's go to Matthew 22, 37 to 40. There was a scribe, a lawyer actually, who asked Jesus about this thing called the law. And what was the greatest commandment in the law? And the word that he used in Aramaic was the word nomosa. The lawyer said, what is the greatest commandment in the nomosa? There's significance to that as we start to unfold this first law and build the brain cells for what was really being spoken about. So imagine the setting. Here's a man who's teaching practical, here's how life works. Here are the laws by which this energy system, and for me, my background is in electronics, and when I first heard the Aramaic language, one of the major things that excited me was that I could see that it was an energy systems language. It was a physics language. It describes to us exactly the way this energy system called life works, and what the physicists are finally understanding. In fact, if you listen to Einstein, Einstein said that his theory of relativity would be of more interest to theologians than it would be to physicists. Because he knew what he was talking about. And the Aramaic language is a physics language. So what is the first law? What's the first and most important commandment that was given? And Jesus said to him, thou shalt love the Lord thy God with all thy heart, with all thy soul, with all thy mind. This is the first and great commandment. In other words, number one, there's an object of attention called God. When you think of God and recognize and what medicine is now showing us is that the mind functions through every cell in the structure. Now they're finding neuropeptides in every cell. They used to think they were just in the brain. They're now finding them in every cell. The mind functions through every cell in the structure. So what was Jesus saying at this point? He was saying when you think of God, every cell in your being has to resonate with love. If you have a reality called hatred, called fear, called anger, called the one that you did when you, or the one that you felt when you did what you now regret having done that we asked about at the beginning of the workshop, If you have that in your structure somewhere, when you think of the Creator, you've broken the first law. And once you break the first law, you might as well forget the rest until you come back into harmony with that. So he said, this is the first and greatest commandment. And then he said, the greatest law in the Orita. Now, the scribe asked, or the lawyer asked, about the Mnemosa. Jesus didn't answer his question. In the Aramaic language, he referred not to the Mnemosa, he referred to the Orita. And the difference between those two, and we'll unfold it a little more, is that one is effect law and one is cause law. Man passes rules and regulations in our culture and tries to control effects, never dealing with causes. You cannot gather enough money and wealth to survive in a culture that tries to pass laws to control effects. You will only be able to survive and prosper well, and I mean on every level, in a culture that understands cause law and lives by cause law. If we have within us the cause law, and for everything that happens, there is a cause. If we have within us the cause law for hatred and fear and murder, then we will, if that's in our personal code system, then we will hate and fear and murder. And it doesn't matter how many laws somebody passes. You know, somebody, go back to that question I asked at the beginning, how many did something that you now regret having done? What would happen if, under pain of death, our human legislature passed a rule, we won't do this, the disservice of calling it a law, that said, you are not allowed to feel that anymore. Would we all be dead soon? Cancel the image? You better believe we would. Because you can't pass laws to control effects and control effects. Because the causes are already set in motion. Now, it's interesting, in our society, it's against the law to go into, say, for instance, a school like Columbine and talk about cause law. You get thrown out in your ear. You get put in jail. You get sued by some parent because you're teaching a child what cause is. No, it is sufficient to bring these children in and whack into their heads with emotional abuse, sometimes with physical abuse, by treating them in a demeaning manner, which is one of the causes of criminality. You have to whack into their heads that effect law. And once you recognize that if you're trying to force an effect to change by creating rules and regulations to stop that effect, it's not possible. What you've got to do is deal with and teach cause law. And Jesus made that shift in this statement in the Aramaic language. He didn't talk about effect law, namosa. He talked about cause law, orita. So he said, that's the first one. That's the most important one. And the second is like unto it. Thou shalt love thy neighbor. He named the second object of attention as thyself. A third object of attention. So what is he saying here? He's saying that you must keep the condition. In Aramaic, the word love, and there is no word for this or that resembles this in the Greek language. There is no word that resembles this in the English language. We have to put string several words together to try to approximate the Aramaic meaning. But in the Aramaic language, there are 17 different words that have been translated by one English word, love. And the word that was used in this particular situation was the word rachma. And he was talking about the cause of sane behavior. He said, you've got three objects of attention. In this, in Aramaic, this word neighbor is not a physical word, it's a mental word. So when he said you've got to love neighbor, he was saying you've got to keep a condition in your mind called neighbor for anybody that you think about. In Aramaic, neighbor means Anyone you think about, if they come into your mind, they are your neighbor. And if you want to do same behavior, you must keep the condition of rachma, which is love, within your mind. If you fail that test, if you fail that law, then you will do what you regret. You will do what does not bring you into the highest and best levels of your creative process and your creative potential. This was not some kind of a religious philosophy or even a nice philosophy. It is a survival philosophy. Because if you can't do it, you won't survive long. And we think somebody in our culture who lives to be 100 years of age has really survived a long time. But, you know, we're eternal beings. Energy is eternal. And to destroy an eternal energy system in 100 years or less is a pretty short lifetime. And you look back in the scriptures and they said there'll come a time when your whole life will become a prayer. And that is that you will be able to step into this space of love for whoever and whatever your object of attention is. And as you're able to do that, everything will change. And then he gives another big clue to how to run a life. The last, and perhaps when we understand it, as important or maybe even more important than this first part of it in our culture at this point for people to grasp and to understand, because there is so much misunderstanding about these scriptures. And what he said was, upon these two commandments hang the law. Upon these two commandments hang the, and now we're talking about the actual law, not man's rules and regulation, the law and it was a possessive word, its prophets. What he was giving here was a criteria for how to study the scriptures, how to study the law and the prophets. Why would that be? Well, remember we talked about our friend from the jungles. He sees this aeroplane, but having no brain cells for aeroplane, what he sees is a bird. Does his mind show him an aeroplane? No. It shows him an outline, but the meaning, the reality that comes up in his mind is bird. So when you recognize that in a time frame, and there's some Harvard statistics that tell us that inside of our mind, in a time frame where 10,000 brain cells fire, that is, there are 10,000 measurable units of electrical activity, then in that time frame, our reality, the images and such that our mind shows us, is made up of a maximum of 9 bits of information. And in the same time frame, actuality contains, it's been estimated, perhaps 25 billion bits of information. You're looking at a tiny fragment, when you look at your reality, of what's going on inside of you. You don't see what's going on out there. And so just like the person who looks at the airplane and says, bird, solid, hard, like stone, no feathers, mouth, spits out people, eats people again. That's the meaning, that's the reality that comes up in his mind. The person who looks at the law and its prophets, the same way that the words on the page are nothing but an energy field, a reflection of the frequencies of light, in the way that the airplane reflects light, that law and prophet set up a frequency. Those words on the page hit an antenna called the eye or the ear, and that causes brain cells to fire. And what this person sees is not what's on the page. What this person hears is not what was meant by the words on the page. What this person feels about it is not what's on the page, it's what's going on, what's firing, what's resonating within them, what's in their brain cell structure. And so if one holds within their minds, let's say, hatred and murder, the cause, the recipes for hate and murder, what do you suppose they'll be able to do? they'll be able to take the teachings of the law and the prophets, and in particular, in the name of a man named Jesus, and they'll be able to say, and now let's go kill the enemy. Because what they heard when they read the law and the prophets was not what the law and the prophets were saying, but what that resonated in them. And if what resonated in them, if the filters of hostility or fear were active in them, what resonated, what they heard as they read the law and the prophets, were the meanings they held in their minds. The same as our friend from the jungles only heard the meanings that this fellow held in his mind. He heard bird, hard skin, mouth. That's what he saw. That's the meaning he had. You can't get a meaning out of your mind that isn't there. So here's Jesus working with these disciples for an extended period of time, and he says, there are so many things I want to say to you, but you can't hear them yet. And then somebody comes along 100 years later, 200, 300, 500, 700, 1,000, 2, 3, 4 cultures away, and says, this is what it means. And this person can only translate at the level of their comprehension and understanding. Who can translate? Who can comprehend what we don't know about what he said? No one who doesn't have the brain cells for it. Until we start building the brain cells, there can't be comprehension. And he gave us the criteria for studying it and being able to do it. In this first law, as part of it, he gave the criteria for how to get to build the brain cells. And what he said was, when you think about the law and the prophets, you've got to make sure that the first condition, the first criteria you meet is, when you think of God, there is no hate or murder in you. When you think of neighbor, there's only the condition of love. There is no hate and murder in you. When you think of self, there is no hate and murder in you. And if you can meet that criteria, if those things are gone, are forgiven in you, then you can study the law and the prophets, and it'll make sense. You'll build the brain cells for what was actually said, because the condition of love will be in your mind. And what is the condition of love? Put the presence of God in you. That's all it is. You listen to Paul. He said the goal of the work was to be of like mind with Christ. What mind did Christ think with? He thought with the mind of God. And God's not mysterious. God's real simple, basic, and straightforward. God is love. So if we can meet this criteria, if we can keep God's mind active in our mind when we think of God or neighbor, so let's imagine you go to neighbor and you have the condition of love in your mind, and that neighbor gives you the look and you have hate in you, what happens? The condition of love is gone because that look resonates hatred. So when you can meet the criteria, when you think of God, neighbor, and self, and have a clean mind that's connected to the mind of God, you have a mind that will teach you everything there is to know about the law and the prophets. He gave us the code for how to read the code, for how to decode it, and how to make sense of it. And once you start to do that, the whole thing makes such perfect sense. And it simply becomes, here's how the energy system works. So we need to start to deal with the cause law of life instead of the effect law of life. We hear a lot of talk in our culture today about morals and ethics. Well, in Greek, the word ethos meant customs of the people. There was no divine part in the ethos of the people. The mores, morals, was a Roman word. What did the mores mean in the Roman culture? It meant the customs of the people. It had nothing to do with God's laws. What did the common man and the religious culture and the legal culture, remember this was a lawyer that asked him this question, what did they engage in their culture? They engaged in the orita. If they understood Jesus. But if they didn't, what did the lawyer ask him? Tell me, what's most important in the mnemosa? What's the most important custom of the people, he's saying. Now remember another point where Jesus went to them, went to the religious leaders in the day, and he said, why do you teach the commandments of man in place of the laws of God? He was basically saying, why do you engage in the mnemosa, the morals, the ethics, the customs of the people, rather than step into the laws of God? And that's what he answered with. And he wasn't answering a religious question. He was showing people how to have a sane mind and how to live a life of health. Because if God is active in your mind, if the mind of God is active in you, and neighbor comes along and gives you the look, and you've practiced and you've created a discipline of allowing love to stay in your mind, then that hatred or fear or whatever that neighbor resonates in you will come forward. And by being exposed to the mind of God, it will disappear. That's a law. You can count on it. If you can hold the mind of God active while your fear, your hatred, your sadness, your grief, or whatever it is that's in you from your genetics and your environment that's in your personal code, and you hold the mind of God active there, it will disappear, that insanity. You will heal. It's the key to healing. And if we want to have a science, we've got to deal in the cause law. We can't deal in the effect law. Mnemosa, mores, ethos are all just the customs of the people. We need to go back to cause. Einstein knew how to go back to cause. In fact, Einstein knew so well how to go back to cause that he understood that what was going on in the world of science when he was in his glory, when he was in his heyday, was nothing but hogwash. In fact, let me read what Einstein said about the science of his day. He said, all of our science, when compared with actuality, is primitive and childlike. What was he saying? He was saying the same thing as Jesus said when he shifted from mnemosa to orita, to cause law. He was saying, folks, here we are, at least this would be my interpretation of what Einstein said. He would be saying with that statement, here we are, folks, we're fooling around with all this 10,000 bits of information firing in our brain cells and 9 bits of information, and we call this reality, and we think we've got it all figured out because we've got some science about this. And he said, this, when compared with this, is primitive and childlike. I think we could have easily seen Jesus when the lawyer asked him about the mnemosa. We could have easily said, you know, you guys got these customs of the people. You got these rules that men have. And those rules are crazy. In fact, when compared to the mnemosa, they are primitive and childlike. Give them up. I'm giving you the real thing. I'm giving you the real stuff, he said. So those mnemosa are the behavioral rules. They are not cause law. And it's time for us to step into understanding. Jesus was not giving people religious tenets and principles. He was teaching them how to manage their lives and their minds and how to study how the laws of the universe operated in their lives. And as we step into harmony with those and we bring our personal code into harmony with those, then as Blackstone said, we will engender such happiness because we have become intimately connected with the eternal laws. And we function out of them, and any part of us that cannot, we allow it to surface and we gently set it aside and heal. And our purpose in looking at the laws of living is to bring us to that state of healing. And I join you in that.